All right, let's see if we can, whoop.
There
we go. Okay. I know you've all been dying to find out about the Clooney Act reform, so I thought I would tell you about that. We're still looking at this sort of post Dark Ages, if you will, post Charlemagne, and when Charlemagne, after he died, the Holy Roman Emperor, sort of his power waned as well, and that allowed the papacy to really sort of elevate itself to prominence. So we're still in that context of papal supremacy. So the Holy Roman Empire becomes increasingly a Germanic institution. It began primarily as a Frankish institution with Charlemagne and his lineage, but over time that lineage sort of, with many monarchs, they have a tendency to inbreed. And when you do that, it tends to weaken your line. And that certainly happened in Charlemagne's case. The last of Charlemagne's heirs died in 911. And many of the monarchs that followed were very weak. Only one of them, was Otto the First, was a strong monarch. He was the king of the Germans from 936 to 973. Otto was instrumental in stabilizing the empire, and he did that by using bishops and abbots rather than relying on the authority of the Pope. So he's looking at what he understood to be the real power in the church, which was at the local level, which we also understand. The real power of the church is at the local level, not at a hierarchical level, which is why we don't, as a PCA, we don't have a hierarchy, right? The real power of the PCA rests in the congregation as it elects its leaders. And then those elders exercise the authority God has given to them in the congregation at the presbytery level, which is the regional area, and then in the denomination as a whole. So Otto understands that and uses these bishops and abbots to bring some stability. These individuals controlled large areas or territories, but at the same time, and this is nothing new, if you wanted ecclesiastical power, then, or if you wanted power in the government, then you needed these ecclesiastical appointments, right? If I'm going to exercise authority as the king in the land, and bishops and abbots are going to be instrumental, then if I want to be instrumental in the exercise of the government with the people, then I am going to clamor for these positions. And so it becomes very prominent to have bishops and abbots sort of be appointees of various rulers. And we see this with every, even in our system of government, though we elect our officials, the cabinet positions are appointed. And we see all sorts of interesting people get appointed to those positions. We see nepotism, we see power, we see, you know, if you have corruption, well, yes. Government by its nature is corrupt. By its nature is corrupt because it's exercising its authority out of a fallen world. So we need to understand that. So Otto is crowned Holy Roman Emperor in 962. When I was studying this, I realized that 1,000 years before I was born, Otto was crowned Holy Roman Emperor. Which is... What's that? We must have some cosmic connection, yes. After Otto, again, his sons don't do very much. And so in 1039, Henry III becomes emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. If you want to read the history of the Henrys, it is fascinating. You had some really good Henrys, and you had some really not so good Henrys. Maybe certainly the most infamous is Henry VIII. Perhaps the greatest Henry was Henry VI. Any of you read Shakespeare's Henry V or VI? Yeah, those are good reads as well. It's always Andy that reads those. I have a collection of Shakespeare's works if anybody wants to borrow it. So. Henry was a deeply religious man, and he became friends with the leaders of the monastery in Cluny, which is in France. This monastery strictly observed the rule of Benedict. We talked about the rule of Benedict, I don't know, a month or so ago. It was a means or a way of ordering monastic life so that it accomplished the things that it needed to accomplish, one of which was that it cared for the poor. So often they would have hospitals, they would have kitchens where they could feed the hungry, they would have schools so that they could teach the children as well, and they were serious about theological study. So they were sort of the people who were keeping alive the teachings of the church, if you will. The bishops and cardinals and even the Pope, much of religious life took a second position to sort of everyday rule. And so they were more concerned with keeping order. They were more concerned with establishing rules that kept people in line and those sorts of things rather than theological issues. Interesting, for us, we see the church, the Westminster Confession says that the church is wholly ecclesiastical. That is, it is wholly outside of the realm of the ordinary governmental status. Because when we gather here together, we gather as representatives of a kingdom that is not of this world. So, and the Roman Catholic Church, having taken the ideas or the understandings of Augustine in the City of God, where there are two cities, but they understood the City of God as the Roman Catholic Church and really began to see that as just another earthly kingdom. And you don't have to read the scriptures very much to figure out that God's kingdom is not of this world. It's otherworldly. We're going to talk about that today in our sermon as well. So Henry is friends with the leaders at Cluny, and at the same time, the papacy is being controlled by wealthy Italian nobles. They bought and sold popes for their purposes. Interesting. Yes, some of the popes at this time were, to call them scoundrels would be too nice. They were not good men. They were not good men. Again, they were put in those positions in order to grant favors to those who were wealthy. The monastery... where am I? I don't have that in my notes. The monastery placed itself under the protection of the people and began to attack simony and the control of church officials by civil authority. So they're attacking this idea of appointees in the church by civil authorities. Simony is the buying and selling of ecclesiastical offices. Where does that come from in the Bible? Simon the magician, what did he want to do? He wanted to be able to do the miracles that the apostles were doing, and so he offers money. All right, so that word simony comes from that notion of offering money or buying ecclesiastical office, right? I want to be in a position of power. It's interesting. We have a sort of that, if you will, today, but it only appears in the ultra mega church movement, and often it happens in the sort of health and wealth world, where it's more nepotism than anything. But if I'm a famous preacher of a massive church and I have to have a succession plan, more than likely, who am I going to hand the keys over to? My son, right? So we have Joel Osteen, right, who didn't do anything to get what he has other than being the son of his father. In some sense, don't take offense to this. Well, you can if you want, but I don't mean it as offensive. But we see that in Franklin Graham as well. We certainly see that in Franklin Graham. There's a sense in which we, in some ways, it makes sense if it's a good thing. But if it's not, it becomes just another vehicle for this kind of thing to go on.
You wouldn't put them in the same class.
No, I would not. I would not. No, I would not put them in the same class. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I'm not. I mean, obviously, we're going to hear about shoeboxes today. They don't do everything great, right? We have to be honest about those kinds of institutions, but they do good work, and that's why we support them, okay? Unlike, you know, if any of you have a copy of a book by Joel Osteen, if you don't have a fireplace, go find one and burn it, okay? Go burn it. Henry was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire again, 1039 to 1056. At the same time, the papacy is controlled by these Italian nobles, so Henry decides to correct this. He deposes the pope and appoints the next several successors, which is interesting. He's trying to undermine this rogue idea of having ecclesiastical appointees for political power. At the same time, his answer to that problem is by doing what? By doing the same thing, by putting popes in power in order to rectify something that he saw as wrong. His best appointment, if you will, certainly the best known one, was Leo IX, who was pope from 1049 to 1054. The reason Leo was a good guy is that he institutes a reform movement within the Roman Catholic Church. You know, we talk about the Reformation, 1517, and all of that, but there are many reform movements going on in the church, really from the beginning all the way through. It's just that most of the reform movements didn't go far enough. They didn't quite bring the Roman Catholic Church out of heresy and back into orthodoxy. They did little bits here and little bits there. Or you had men who really did try to bring those kinds of reforms, and they were often burned or dismembered or some other such horrible end. So he reorganizes the College of Cardinals, allowing men who were outside of Rome to represent the church. Now, it's interesting, until the most recent appointee to pope, there had never been a pope elected from outside of Europe. This is the first one. Pope Francis was from Argentina, which is pretty remarkable. But that idea began with Leo. the idea that you don't have to be Italian in order to be the pope. Up to this point, every pope had been Italian. So he recognizes if you have a limited pool, then the dangers or the reality of abuse is much greater. If you can go outside of that, then you can mitigate at least some of those temptations. He attacks simony, he attacks priestly marriages, and he travels extensively in an effort to strengthen church reforms. For us, you know, traveling extensively means hopping on a plane, flying somewhere. When the king was traveling back then, it was a big deal because it might mean a 2-month journey somewhere just to get somewhere. It's hard for us to comprehend that. Leo is remembered most for the final break between the East and the West. So one of his legacies, if you will, is the final separation between Eastern Orthodoxy and the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope wanted to gain control over certain churches in Italy because those churches were loyal to the Patriarch in Constantinople. If I'm the Pope of the church, I can't have churches in my own backyard who aren't loyal to me but are loyal to someone else. So he closes many of those churches. He deposes some of those priests and bishops in order to gain power or control over those churches. So the Patriarch of Constantinople then closes the churches that are in the East that are loyal or sympathetic to the Pope. Right? Tit for tat. Again, we see this all the time. That leads then to the final schism. In 1054, so you have churches in Italy loyal to Constantinople that are being meddled with by the Pope. You have churches in Constantinople or in the East that are loyal to Rome that have been meddled with by the Patriarch of Constantinople. So in 1054, Leo sends ambassadors to Constantinople, and they place a writ of excommunication of the Patriarch on the altar of St. Sophia. It's gotten really serious, yes. This marks the final separation between Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism. They have, over the last 20 years or so, made some attempts to sort of come back together. They'll never come back together wholly or fully because the Eastern Church has lived for 1,000 years without a pope. And so for them to just say, yeah, we'll just forget about all of that and we'll submit ourselves to the authority of the pope, it's just not going to happen. But they have made some progress in terms of levels of work together and things that hadn't happened. Carol, you grew up in an area where Orthodox and Roman Catholic, they didn't even talk to each other, right?
I wasn't even allowed to go.
Okay, right. That's not that long ago that we had that level of animosity between East and West. Yeah.
I had a priest who was
a
teacher who was an Eastern
Catholic. Yes, which is a whole, they're very small. They are allowed to marry.
Yeah, and they're Eastern Orthodox, but they hope as...
Right, Catholic. Right. So their practice is essentially Eastern Orthodoxy. Any of you been to an Eastern Orthodox church? I know you have, right? It's filled with icons and those sorts of things. And so they have those kinds of things going on in their practices, but at the same time, they have their allegiance to the Pope in Rome. And they're allowed to marry. There are two groups in Roman Catholicism in terms of the priesthood that are allowed to marry. One is the Eastern Catholics. The other is are the Syrian Catholics. And it was a compromise. At some point, they had a whole bunch of priests who were married, and they didn't want the priests to put away their wives, so they allowed marriage. And so that has continued to this day. But for the most part, even up to this point, these two institutions, if you will, had grown considerably apart. And it really happened probably in the 400s and 500s, significantly, because that was when the Western Church really began to emphasize Latin and to put away Greek. And so you had the Eastern Church, which is oriented towards Greek, and you have the Western Church that is oriented toward Latin. And it's, I mean, as silly as or as simple as it is they just didn't speak the same language anymore. Same thing, yes. So Eastern Orthodoxy has a whole, you have patriarchs in various places. And so there are different persuasions of Eastern Orthodoxy. You have probably the one that we're most familiar with would be Greek Orthodox, or Russian. You were Russian Orthodox, right? So if you're Russian Orthodox, you're loyal to the patriarch in St. Petersburg. It's not called St. Petersburg anymore. Or it is, yes. It used to be Leningrad or something, right? Now it's back to St. Petersburg. You have an Antiochian Orthodoxy, and they're probably, I have some friends that have left Protestantism and have gone into the Antiochian Orthodoxy. They're probably the closest to us in terms of belief in the gospel and those sorts of things. They still have all the trappings of Orthodoxy as well. In some sense, the Coptic Christians of Egypt are part of the Eastern Orthodox world, although they tend to do their own thing. But you do have a patriarch in Alexandria, in Egypt as well. There is a patriarch in Jerusalem. You know, Jerusalem is a city divided in more ways than just one. You know, we think of Muslim and Christian, but you have Muslim, you've got Roman Catholic, you've got Eastern Orthodox, and then you have a fairly substantial evangelical presence there. And so you have this this interesting mix of Jerusalem, if you will. Where am I? Leo sends a group, excommunicates the patriarch in Constantinople. So in response, again, gotta respond. The Eastern Patriarch closed certain churches in the East that gave allegiance to Rome, and reasserts all of the charges of heresy that had been made by Photius. We looked at the Photian controversy last week, and he added one more. He condemned the practice of the Latin Church of using unleavened bread in the Lord's Supper. What kind of bread do we use?
Unleavened
bread. Why do we use unleavened bread? The spiritual answer is because of Passover. The reality is, it's because where is our heritage? It's the Roman Catholic Church. I say that partly with tongue in cheek, but we haven't really wrestled with this issue too much in evangelicalism. And you can go to a lot of evangelical churches when they celebrate the Lord's Supper, and what do they have? They have a loaf of bread. You've been, all right? You have a loaf of bread? Okay. So apparently those Dutch, they... you too? Okay. Yeah. It's it's interesting, but it was one of the things that was separating the East and the West. The East said it must be unleavened, or it must be leavened. It must be leavened, and the West said it must be unleavened. So here's a question I have for you. Who's right? That's the right answer. It really doesn't matter. We don't live in a culture where unleavened bread is significant. We live in a heritage where it was, but the point of Passover was that they had to make bread in haste. And in order to make bread in haste, yeast takes time. And so you have unleavened bread so that you can take it with you. Also, unleavened bread tends to last longer than leavened bread. Because leavening, it goes through the whole batch, right? Jesus uses leaven in two different ways. Jesus uses leaven as a bad thing, and he uses it as a good thing, right? In some sense, the Holy Spirit is leaven for us, right? And so... Again, it doesn't matter whether you have unleavened or leavened bread. I happen to prefer unleavened. Number one, it just is easier. And there are some reasons why pragmatism is okay in certain settings. And in that case, it works for us. We're actually chewing on... That was the wrong word. Maybe that is the right word. We're having conversations at the session level about our practice of the Lord's Supper. And you'll be hearing some more about that. But one of them is the kind of bread we use. What is it that we ought to be doing? And we haven't come to any decision yet, so I can't tell you. Of course, that relates then to the cup as well, right? What is the cup called in the Bible? Well, it is a cup of blessing. It is the fruit of the vine. What word do we get in English from the word vine? Vino, wine, yes. We're having that discussion as well. And... The Lord's Supper is to be bread, and it can be leavened or unleavened, and it is to be the fruit of the vine, and it can be unfermented or fermented. The interesting part of the church, again, you'll hear much more about this, but one of the history, really the history of the church is for about 1,850 years, the church only used one thing. Wine. Fermented. And I have heard some say, well, you know, the early church, they watered it down. Well, yes, they did. They didn't water it down in order to cut the alcohol. They watered it down because they didn't have enough wine, and they had to make it go further, and so they watered it down. All right.
Their water was not good.
That is true. They had to have fermented drinks in order to make things drinkable. The other side of that is, we use grape juice in evangelicalism predominantly because of a family in New Jersey that was committed to prohibition and temperance. What was their name? Welch. Welch's grape juice came about because of temperance. Yeah. They were committed Methodist temperance people. Okay, yes. It is, yes. And that was one of the other issues, we looked at that before, is and many of the reformers are going to bring this up.